Welcome to the European CME Forum podcast. European CME Forum is a not-for-profit organization that promotes multi-channel discussion on matters relating to European and global CME CPD. My name is Eugene Pozniak. I'm the program director of European CME Forum. This is the first of four podcast episodes where I'll be speaking with the moderator of a plenary session taking place at 14 ECF this November. On today's episode, I'm joined by Lawrence Sherman, who will be moderating the plenary session that we have titled Rules and Regulations. Rules and Regulations is the first leg in our model of the three-legged stool for achieving balance for effective CME. The focus of today's episode is Lawrence's involvement in the European CME Forum and also an update on the changing world of CME CPD. Lawrence, I suppose it's morning for you today. How are you doing?
It is almost the end of morning for me, and I am fantastic today. How about you, my friend?
Excellent. It's been sort of quite a long day, but it's still the beginning of the week, so lots of energy, and just looking forward to chatting with you about 14 ECF, and I've been having quite a few conversations with different people as they're coming on board with the faculty, so I'm delighted you can join us today. And just to run through a few things, just your thoughts, you know, still early days, the planning, folk are coming in, giving us their opinions on the SurveyMonkey survey. It's quite interesting how people are responding to the pandemic and what they're expecting from medical education, and also what they're expecting from us as sort of a education meeting about medical education, you know, not just European CME Forum, but what everyone, providers, societies, accreditors, industry are looking to get from sort of the medical meetings like ours. So this is really interesting. So it'll be fantastic just to spend a bit of time together, maybe mulling over some of those details and, seeing where you think the environment is going as far as, you know, IME, medical education, CME is evolving and what you think we should be covering as European CME Forum this November.
Sure. So I'm proud to say that I've been a part of all of the prior ECFs. And what's interesting to me, Eugene, is that if you think back to one ECF, how different the environment is, even without considering pandemia and the such, how we've seen a real evolution and ebbs and flows in the world that we've lived in for the last 14 years. So I think, I started looking for the silver lining in the pandemic, right? Because there's gotta be some positives that come out of it. And maybe, Eugene, some of the positives that come out of it is one, the rest of the health professions education continuum will catch up to CPD with how we embraced e-learning 20 years ago, right? So we had some best practices, and I can tell you personally, I was able to share best practices from CPD and back in the CME days with folks in the undergraduate and postgraduate world because they had to scramble to figure out how to be digital educators or use more digital education tools. And we've always been doing it, right? So there's that. So there's that silver lining. Two, I think it allowed us to reflect on what we had been doing and how often, and you and I have talked about this for years, we kept saying, well, that's the way we've always done it and it's worked. So why would we want to change? So most people didn't want to change, didn't think about change, and only had to change when change was thrust upon them. So I think it allowed some self-reflection, self-assessment, and change. And I think we had to facilitate that with all of our other stakeholders in IME, CME, CPD, IPCE, because, you know, we had to sort of scramble fast and we had to help make sure that our education was being delivered. Our education was appropriate. Our faculty were appropriately trained, that we were assessing appropriately, that we were providing education in the format on the topics that our learners needed most. So there were some positives that came out of it. And we also learned a lot about unlearning and upskilling and reskilling and words that people hadn't thought about in our world before.
Yeah, no, that's a fantastic overview of our journey over the years. Now, if we can just take a little pause here, because maybe not everyone on this podcast will actually know who Lawrence Sherman is. Can you actually just describe your background and so your journey as we've been working together on European CME Forum over the past 14 years? Because, of course, you've been involved in a few different ways. But can you just give us a brief introduction to yourself for newcomers?
Sure. So way back in the day, when I was young and had hair, I initially embarked on a clinical educational career. And when I realized that clinical medicine wasn't what I had thought it was going to be, I had already been doing some teaching. I got a certificate in adult education, and I started the journey in our world of health professions education, continuing education, over 27 years ago. And for nearly the first 25 years, I worked as primarily a provider of continuing education, mostly in the industry supported world. And I led several companies and was responsible for developing tons and tons of educational activities, tried to incorporate some interesting engagement interactive strategies into them. 2 years ago, I sort of pivoted a little bit. It's 2.5 years ago now, by starting my own company, Meducate Global. And what I do there is I help organizations incorporate learning science and really educational strategies into their mix and to really take it up a notch. And I do a fair amount of work with the Association for Medical Education in Europe, AMI, in an international development role, where we're doing a couple of big things. One, we're assessing the CME systems in so far over 30 countries in Latin America, the Middle East, North Africa, China, and we're about to embark on Europe. And that'll lead to a publication. We're also working on a project where we're trying to do capacity building of CPD educators around the world, where we're developing a modular sort of interactive course for CPD educators and professionals around the world. And that should see the light of day next year as well.
Great, fantastic. So thank you for an overview that really shows that you've seen the medical education scene, not just in the US or Europe, but really globally from a number of different angles. And that's a great overview, and actually some exciting stuff there that hopefully we're going to hear more about in November as well. Because, of course, we've already discussed how the work that you're doing within the looking at the medical education systems in different countries around the world, how this actually affects sort of the scene that our traditional provider group, especially, and as well as the accreditors and the medical societies, are interacting with as the European CME Forum participants, just how understanding this environment globally, not just from the continuing education end of the spectrum, but right from undergraduate to specialist training, etc. Can you say a few words about what you've seen in the past couple of years and the evolutions then, how that affects our sort of traditional European CME Forum participant base?
Yeah, it's sort of been an anecdotal experience leading into an evidence-based realization, right? So what, and you and I, for full disclosure, have worked on many projects together around the world. And so we have experienced a lot of this, where some of the struggles that maybe we didn't have within a European or UK specific or US or North American specific educational activity, we started to experience difficulties, really challenging difficulties with recruiting participants and understanding the learning environment in which we were trying to teach. And I think what we learned a lot was not every place in the world embraces and follows structured systems like the ones that many of us are used to being a part of. And that the worst thing in the world is to try to take a system that you're in and bring it or a product of it into another place if the other place either didn't ask for it or isn't ready for it. We assume that all learners around the world want to participate in the symposia that we set up, or the meetings that we set up, or the webcasts that we set up. And the reality is, if you don't understand the learning environment, the learners, the expectations, and the world in which they are practicing, you really can't be an effective CME educator, right? There are places around the world that would shock you, Eugene, that you would expect that there's a formalized system that everybody commits to lifelong learning and wants and is looking for and thrives because there's a plethora of content that will help them be better practitioners and lead to better patient outcomes. But the reality is that's not true. In some places, and whether they're a low or middle income country or a first world country, if the environment doesn't support the strategy, it ain't going to work. And there's a saying that I heard, you know, culture eats strategy for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So you could go in and you could have the greatest, most thought out, thoughtful strategy. But if the environment in which you're going in to provide this education isn't ready for it, isn't used to it, or doesn't know what to do with it, or has learners that don't know what to do, well, then it's not going to work. And then you're saying, but it's the greatest education in the world. How could they not want to participate? And there's tons of reasons, and that'll come out in the papers that we're publishing next year.
Right. No, and I'm really hoping that it'll come out in the session that you're contributing to as well. Which will be sort of session two, the one that we're looking at. It's labeled sort of rules and regulations, but it's not just looking at, you know, the usual. I'm not even going to sort of go down that alleyway of which rules they are, because it's exactly as you're saying. If the environment, whether it's the national or the environment of the learners, doesn't match some kind of larger strategy, there's no point trying to shove this round peg into a square hole. If the learners don't need the education, or the education doesn't meet the learners' needs, however many rules and regulations you may put in place, you can't force them to do this. And same with the sort of looking at who the providers are in each of these territories, countries, environments, they vary across the world as well. So it really isn't a one size fits all, and especially not from the Western world when we go further afield where you've done a lot of work. Of course, we've got the Japan paper, your work in Japan has already been published in JECME, where already we can see that it's a world away from what we would describe as the usual medical education environment in Western Europe.
Yeah, well, so if you start from Japan and work forward, right? Japan, it's as important to understand the culture in which you're operating. You know, so it's not just a translation exercise, right? I think a lot of us for years thought, well, if we take the content that we have and we translate it into Japanese, Mandarin, Spanish, whatever, that it will be relevant, right? And I think that's not true, right? Because there's context as well as content. And if the needs assessment wasn't based on the needs and practice environment and gaps within that particular country, region of a country, or even getting down to like an institution, well, then the education is nice to have, but not need to have. And it may be irrelevant if product, drug, guideline is different from country to country. Well, then it's really not helpful to say, well, here's a program that was developed in the UK, let's bring it to Botswana, right? Because there's two different practice environments. So that's really important. The other thing is, in Japan, what we saw was there's no requirement to participate in the CME system. The Japan Medical Association has a CME system, but it's not mandatory. It's not compulsory. It's voluntary. Less than half of the specialist physicians participate. And what we learned is many of the specialist physicians participate in little, if any, CME throughout their career. And there's a culture of the patients being very acceptive of whatever education their healthcare practitioner had, because the level of respect is very high. So it's really interesting. The nice thing is the head of the CME Promotions Committee of the Japan Medical Association is a terrific guy, and he wants to be a change agent. So there's change that's being discussed. But still, when we did the research in 2018, published it in 2019, it was still, this is what the future could hold. So it's challenging. And then if you look at the other 30 some odd countries that we've studied, well, A, we don't prepare people for lifelong learning. B, sometimes it's just a matter of survival. There was one country where the first year after you graduate, you have to go into the jungles of the country and provide local care. And there, one of the statistics that they track is how many of the trainees are killed. So if you think of the world in which you and I grew up and we work in, that's not something that we would even imagine, right? But even in the US and the Western world, we're starting to think, you know, we're not necessarily preparing our students to be lifelong learners quite yet, right? So we need to teach people what it's going to be like when they're out in the practicing world. So when they're students, we have to indoctrinate this idea of lifelong learning and where to go. Because 10 years ago, in my TEDx talk, Eugene, I talked about the US model of 4+4+40, which was 4 years of medical school, an average of 4 years of postgraduate training, and then 40 years of go find your own education, right? because there's structure, and then there's the world. So there's so much. And I think because we work in such a small part of such a big world, I think it's shocking to us when we encounter these environments and these systems or lack of systems where we expect that everybody behaves the way our healthcare professionals behave.
So you're taking this a step further. You know, in recent years, the kind of conversations you've seen taking place at our European CME forums, if you are there around a table with representatives from the accreditation bodies, maybe the professional societies, the medical societies, associations, even drug company supporters who do support a lot of medical education around the world, and maybe some providers as well. What would be sort of the questions or the points that you would like to bring out with them?
Yeah, so it's less questions and more enlightening points for conversation, right? I think we have to, write this one down, Eugene. We have to embrace heterogeneity and not assume homogeneity. And what I mean there is, do not assume that every single student in every single country from every single medical or nursing or pharmacy or other health school is prepared the same way. And then to the same degree, don't assume that every practicing healthcare professional feels and is prepared the same way to participate in continuing education. So, you know, I love the work that the International Academy of CPD Accreditors is doing, for instance, because they're trying to not harmonize, but at least have some level playing field and leading to mutual recognition of credits around the world. But we also need each of those organizations to embrace the fact that they have to get the people in their own countries on board to want to participate in the system. Because if you have a great system, but it's not mandatory, it's a great non-mandatory system, right? To another degree, if I'm talking to accreditors need to think about whether the learners value or even need their credits. And when the providers have to jump through hoops in an activity accreditation system, and then you realize that the value of the credit to the learners is nil, well, then that's sort of a wake-up call. I mean, you and I have seen this. We've been at booths in conferences, clinical conferences, and I've asked learners, hey, what do you think of the value of the credit? And they don't even know what the credit is, right? And this is not to be insulting to the accreditation systems, the accreditors, the learners, but that's the environment. And I think we've got to learn from our own model. We've got to do our needs assessments. That's what we're hoping comes out of some of these studies that we did, because we did a mixed methods approach, Eugene. So in each country that we went to, we talked to educational experts in sort of a one-on-one or roundtable format to get their perspectives of what they thought the highlights and benefits and challenges of the CME system was. And then we did a survey of the practicing healthcare professionals, so of the learner base. And sometimes the gap between what the experts thought and what the reality was of the practitioners was as wide as the Grand Canyon. So, I mean, that's That's huge, right? And I think we need to learn from that. I'm not saying we have all the answers, but what I'm saying is the data that we're now analyzing is incredibly eye-opening. And, you know, even though we don't realize it, I think you and I probably would agree that we each have an unconscious bias towards the benefit of independent medical education. CME learners want it in the system, but it's from this limited yet vast experience, evidence base that we have, and all of the folks that come to ECF and genuinely in earnest want to do better. But then when we have to go back and do it, implement a global program, we had to realize that the learners are as different could be. That's what I want to talk about with that table of people who wouldn't want to listen.
Okay. Well, I think we'll... And you will have that opportunity. I think it's on the 4th of November with the second session where you'll be moderating parts of that session. Actually, you'll be able to ask questions of that group like that. But this topic really during our pandemic time is coming to the fore, I think, much more. The way that the requirements for CME in those countries that do have a requirement, not just the voluntary side, have they adapted in the past year and a half or not adapted, maybe withdrew their requirements for credit? And precisely what you're saying about sitting, yeah, I remember at that booth asking learner after learner, what are you going to do with the credit? They don't care about the credits. They just want good education. And a podcast that it was a webinar that we ran with the Good CME Practice Group, which we released as a podcast.
It.
Oh, did you? Ah, great. Great you were there. But we had so many questions coming in about the accreditation landscape in Europe. So this is available sort of is released towards the end of September, and it's still available to listen to now. And I think it was Margarita who identified that there were sort of three reasons for that credit, certainly from a European provider perspective. One is the credit certificate itself. The second purpose of going for CME accreditation is that quality assurance that someone has looked at it, an expert has looked at it and validated the content in some way. And the third way is more to do with the compliance of, let's say, the use of funding or recruitment of learners, etc. But it's that first reason that a lot of people assume that learners need the credit has just fallen away, especially in the pandemic. Learners need good quality education. And something that we've seen in the pandemic, where there's a plethora of online education that's come out now, is that this group of learners have become this sort of uber critical consumers, where if the education is of poor quality, or it doesn't address their needs, or it's dull or poorly presented, they switch off because there's always a better place that they can find it.
And that's in our world. But outside of our world, there's not a plethora of content, and people don't know where to look. And people struggle when they do have a question arise, because we live in a world where we have an overabundance of content, and we have the ability for the content to be funded and the education to be free, right? But the reality is there are a lot of places around the world where either topics for continuing education are regulated yearly by ministries of health or other governing bodies. And it's not about needs-based education. It's not about evidence-based education. It's about these are the five topics that we think are important in our country this year from whatever they, and there's a valid reason for that. But that means that a good percentage of the healthcare professionals will not have access to new content, at least within their own environment, because it's not the topic du jour, right? So if the topics are hypertension, diabetes, obesity, and two others, and you're an OBGYN, well, maybe it's tangentially related to your practice, but it's not your day-to-day. Right. So that's the reality. The other thing is, I think a lot those three reasons that you provided from the webinar are subjective. And you need to validate those with the learners. Right. So we've said for years, you and I have said, you know, boy, they love hanging that piece of paper on the wall. Mm-mm. Some people do. Some people don't. Some cultures appreciate it. Some cultures don't. Right. Some cultures say some geographies say, listen, we get enough education within our own hospital, health system, or national society that we don't need to participate in anything else. Our needs are met. And then you say to them, but we have this great thing. And they say, you know what? I don't have time. It could be the greatest thing in the world, but I don't have time. And my needs are met, right? I think we have to change fundamentally the way we're training our healthcare professionals so that they realize that every time they come up with a question in clinical practice, that's the opportunity for some self-directed learning. And we have to give credit for self-directed learning, right? It's like Don Moore talked about at ECF 2 years ago. We have to prepare master adaptive learners. I have a great slide that we worked on from that when I talk about master adaptive learners, which is finding, applying, testing, right? So what they do is they have a clinical question, they go to a trusted resource or reference, they get as much as they can from that, and then they apply it and see, did it work? And then what is the outcome from that, right? There's no pure model of individualized continuing education, right? Because adult learners, we know, blah, 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 the questions arise from daily work or practice. So we need to have education that's supportive of that. And then when you talk about on a global level, we need people to understand where trusted resources live and help them to develop trusted resources and know what to do with it, rather than just saying, we're going to do the greatest symposium at the International Society of Elbow Pain, right? Because while it may be a great symposium about elbow pain for the people that are there, there's a couple billion other people that don't benefit from
it. And I always love discussing these things with you, Lawrence, because I learn new things. And just pointing out what is actually glaringly obvious once we're outside of our own environment is it's quite easy just to sit in our silos and thinking this is how medical education works globally. So now I appreciate those explanations and also the background and to bring in the master adaptive learner as well, just this sort of allowing the learner to actually identify their own needs and manage their own education and sort of guide them in that way, because that seems to be missing sort of in our traditional sort of CME space. But so extrapolating that to the meeting itself and 14 ECF, what do you think so for this coming meeting? And we've talked about quite a few topics already that we will be covering in the meeting, that we're going to be making them available through October. As we've sort of releasing information about the meeting, but from the people you know who are serving on the faculty, the kind of people that we have coming to European CME Forum meetings, what do you think we should be working towards to be the sort of the main takeaways from the conference this year? What are the main issues you think we should really guide people on?
Well, so I'd love every faculty member to bring one lesson learned during the pandemic. Not talk to you about it, not talk to each other about it, just one lesson learned from the pandemic, and have sort of and have them give it to you, and then we can use that as sort of topic for discussion and see how it melds with the topics. But I think what I hope comes out of this meeting is not just, well, we've all become really great digital educators and boy, you know, this is it. But I think what we have to do is we have to say, did the pandemic help to lead to a renaissance of continuing education? And if it has, what are the changes that we've seen or we've seen need to be made? And how do we have a roadmap so that at 15 ECF, the stuff we talk about at 14 ECF can be brought back and said, here's what we did as a result, right? Because I think what we need to do is we need to stop having the continuing conversation about credits. We need to stop having the conversation about educational strategy and design. And what we have to do is we have to be more germane and relevant, right? So if we look at those individual lessons learned, we can either start with that as a needs assessment and say, which of these is, you know, maybe in a nominal group technique fashion, rate these different things. We won't tell you who said them, right? But rate these different things. Do you agree with these things? Because I think if we could leave 14 ECF knowing we answered more questions than we caused, it's a success, right? And if we create our own crop of master adaptive learners subset ECF, then we've done a service rather than a disservice. Because I think what we've done through the years is we've done such a good job of putting the right faculty and the right content on that people leave learning a lot and questioning more. And I think we need that connectivity. So that's what I would encourage you to do as you're thinking it through, because that sort of that germane relational education is what needs to come out of this, not just, well, we don't do that where I am, so it doesn't matter. Or, boy, you know, I'll just keep doing what I'm doing because we have the best 15-minute podcast and webinar that ever happened in the entire universe. And even if the learners don't go there, that's their loss because it was great.
Yeah, and you've described a fantastic approach. And of course, yeah, we've been already discussing this and planning it and how to use the meeting platform that we're having this year. So yeah, we're working with the faculty. Yeah, it's not a case of you've got 10 minutes to speak, say your pitch and then move on. You know, we really want to address questions that come in. So it's really critical importance that people engage in the SurveyMonkey that we're running. The faculty are also engaging in this way. So yeah, we'll structure the sessions like that. You'll be able to structure your session like this. And you hit on a really important point on people attending European CME Forum. We've had this right from the very first meeting that participants should not leave the meeting without all their questions answered. And something that you and I introduced in one of those very, it's, I think it's probably the second European CME Forum, maybe the third one, was that on session at the end. Mm-hmm. And we haven't actually discussed this yet, Lawrence, but why don't we have an on session again this year? We've got the technology. I've been talking to the platform developers. We can actually have this where people can submit their questions and have a fully interactive conversation at the end of session four, after the final Q&A that we're running, is to bring back that on session, which really is a great way of finishing off the meeting where that's it. There's, well, why don't you describe actually the whole purpose of the on session? And once you've agreed to doing this, no, but I hope that you'll find it exciting and that we could work together on how to use the technology to bring this to the virtual world.
Well, I'm actually thrilled that I'm going to be in the same room as you for this meeting. You know, I my ticket's booked. I'm coming to Manchester, and I don't want to jinx it, but it looks like I won't even need to take a COVID test before I fly, because the UK is relaxing vaccinated travelers' requirements. Still a day two, but it can be a lateral flow rather than a PCR. See, we've all become experts in testing. But anyway, I think I love the idea of an on session, and I think we need to put an F in it, right? It's got to be a fun session. Because that's the end, right? We always enjoy that session. And it's not about you and I answering everybody's questions, but it's about getting those questions in and finding the right people to answer it. It's almost like a master adaptive on session, right? Because we need to then go, oh boy, you know, Eugene would be good to answer that one. Robin would be good to answer that one. Graham would be good to answer that one, right? And so we need to have it being very interactive. But the premise of an on session is it's unstructured. It's meant to answer the questions, at least as we've done it, that are persistent, because most people are coming with a question or a concern or an area of interest. And you do a fantastic job every year of trying to put together enough content that will answer the majority of the questions that you've assessed through surveys, et cetera, et cetera. But people still have questions. And it could be, what's the best practice? What do you do? How do I go about doing it? So if we have that unsession, and I would argue, Eugene, there's a benefit to having an unsession a month later as well, right? So that when people go back home and try to figure out what it is that they learned or didn't learn or thought they learned, and there was a challenge, we should do a follow-up with them. Now, I don't know what format that would take, and I don't mean to throw more stuff that's going to cost you more money and headaches, but I do think that leads to that connectivity, because what you've done, Eugene, over 14 years is created a community of learning, right? A community of practice, but in education. So we'll call it a COPE, right? Community practice and education. And we need to cope with each other, right? So we need to be able to answer the questions. And sometimes the questions don't become obvious until later. So maybe we need a little connectivity, and maybe it's not on the conference platform. Maybe it's just a webinar that we do or something. But I do think that we should have an unsession and then a recession, or no, not a recession. That'd be bad, right? That'll cause financial headaches for everyone. But you see where I'm going with this. I think there's probably value to doing it. I don't know if you would describe it any differently, but I think the unsession is meant to answer the questions that came up in the needs assessment that weren't met with other content.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So that's just the questions that people came to the meeting with and what came out. But actually,
or developed. They could come up with a question in the meeting, right? Mm-hmm. And what I would say is we should collect those questions at the moment. Because my personal pet peeve is when I'm in an educational session as a learner, and somebody says, oh, I see you have a question, Q&A is at the end. I am done. The Brooklyn comes out of me, I put up a finger and I leave, right? What we need to do is we need to be collecting those questions and maybe answering some of them before people leave and answering some at the end session. But I think they need to have the opportunity. I know the platform will allow this, but they need to be able to ask the question at the moment it comes up so that they don't forget it. And they feel like we are interested and we want to help them find the answer.
Yeah, no, well put, absolutely. And and I'm delighted you're on the team to help bring the experts together to answer these questions. And and as you're saying, the platform can cope with this kind of approach to the meeting. It's different. It's not I think I put in the one of the email shots, you know, we're avoiding the gloom of Zoom and the kind of straitjacket that, I mean, it's still a fantastic platform, but once we do approach the kind of topics we cover at European CME Forum, it's got to be more collaborative. There's got to be more free discussion and two-way dialogue with the participants. So that's what we're working hard to actually implement and just help to answer these questions.
Yeah, we have to strive for 100% engagement, right? We can't say 25% engagement. We can't say 50% engagement. Every person participating has to feel that at any moment, if they want to submit a question, make a comment, that not only can they do it, but that we'll look at it at that moment.
Yeah. And the people aren't forced to as well, because we do also need to recognize that there are some people who they might be newcomers or they just don't want to switch on the video and say, hey, I'm here. So there is also the ability to just participate by watching and absorbing the information. No one is actually forced to participate like this. So really we're covering off the two ends that, yeah, something like Zoom, if everyone's got their cameras on, everyone is sort of self-conscious. I've sat in quite a few meetings. I'm thinking, well, actually, I just want to listen to what others are discussing, what the experts are saying, how people are reacting, not necessarily to say anything, but it's sometimes quite rude to switch off the camera, at least this way. You just get involved as much or as little as you want partake confidently in the meeting.
Yeah, let me rephrase what I said, because you're right. It's 100% opportunity for engagement. So at any moment in time, anyone that feels that they want to put in a comment, ask a question, challenge the faculty, whatever, they have the opportunity to do it. And if they want to be a lurker and just be a listener and a sponge, that's great too, because we're all different. And that goes back to that point, Eugene, of embracing heterogeneity and not assuming homogeneity, because not everybody wants to yap as much as you and I do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. Well, it's been fantastic yapping today with you about these things. Is there anything else you want to add at this stage?
All I'd say is that I hope the people that will participate in ECF virtually and you know, either asynchronously or synchronously, who engage with us, really help us to understand what it is that they want and need to learn about, and not take for granted that just because we've done all the needs assessment and all that work, that we have all the answers to everything. And I think maybe I'll just go back to that point I just made. I think if everybody realizes that the heterogeneity is what we need to embrace, then maybe they'll be a little bit more open to seeing how things can be done. It's not just about where do I get my next grant, or it's not just about to whom should I give my next grant, and it's not just about which accreditation system is better. At the end of the day, what we're trying to do is help our learners, and we have to understand our learners. And you and I have talked about this for longer than ECF has been in existence. But if the education doesn't fit the learners, then it's not good education. So we need to, if we sort of go in thinking about that, and if we realize that we don't know as much about our learners as we think we do, then maybe we'll be better in the end.
Wonderful. Lawrence, it's been fantastic talking today. Thank you very much for your time. And I look forward to seeing you in person in November and planning in the meantime.
Yes, will you be there with your little chauffeur's cap when I land with a sign?
I might send my man. That was Lawrence Sherman joining me to discuss his involvement at the 14th annual European CME Forum and his learnings from observing CME CPD systems worldwide. Registration is open for the 14th annual meeting, and if you complete our annual survey, you will receive a 10% discount. Your registration will also give you access to the complete archive of the 13th annual European CME Forum, consisting of all the plenary and workshop sessions with over 18 hours of CME CPD content from a faculty of 70 experts in European and global CME. More information on the upcoming 14th annual European CME Forum and this year's JECME special collection can be found on our website, cmeforum.org. Thank you for listening. And join us for more episodes as we explore all things CME CPD.